Hello and welcome to Roots, today's sustainability scene, a podcast produced by journalism students at Mount Royal University in Calgary. This series is powered by Shaw and is a part of the Community Podcast Initiative at Mount Royal University. Roots is based on the Sustainability Forum organized by Mauricio Lutapi, a professor in the Bissett School of Business at MRU. This event featured 20 different presentations examining sustainability from a range of perspectives. This series explores sustainability in interviews with the people who gave those presentations and forum organizers. I'm Alejandro Velasco.
And I'm Sean Gillanders. In today's episode, we'll be talking about travel. Keeping travel sustainable is a big issue in the sustainability scene. We talked to two presenters from the Sustainability Forum about sustainable tourism and aviation.
Joe Pavelka has been teaching at Mount Royal University for over 20 years. He's traveled around the world with his students, teaching about sustainable tourism. I talked to Joe about sustainable tourism to really get a good idea of what sustainable tourism is and how it affects all of us.
I just wanted to start off by kind of touching on sustainable tourism. It's a really interesting topic. However, it's very niche, right? And I myself hadn't heard of it in the past until just these coming weeks. So could you give me a brief explanation of what sustainable tourism is?
Sustainable tourism is a movement within tourism. There are a lot of different forms of tourism, ecotourism, regenerative travel, pro-poor tourism, etc. There's a whole bunch of labels. But sustainable tourism is kind of the umbrella that addresses all forms of tourism that attempt in one way or another to be more environmentally, socially, culturally, and economically sustainable.
And I wanted to touch on a little bit of a word that I encountered during my research, which is over-tourism. From what I've seen, it's become quite the issue. With international tourism being one of the biggest industries in the world, I saw it's like 1.something billion people worldwide are traveling. What would you say the solution to this problem is?
Well, first off, international arrivals have been increasing steadily, and it took a dip during the pandemic, going down to 1990 levels. We're now right back up. So we're about 1.6, 1.8 billion international arrivals, which is very, very high. The term over-tourism has been used a lot in the last 5 to 10 years. And I and a few others do have a problem with that term, even though it is being used all the time. The term over-tourism originally was supposed to be a way to describe overcrowding, but it has morphed into, in the public media, it has morphed into a term that is used by a lot of people who are upset with various elements of tourism in one way or another. I try and stay away from that term just because I think it is so broadly defined. But if we're talking about too many visitors and we're talking about overcrowding, then that is that's a big issue. One of the ways that that's addressed globally is by trying to move visitors into tourism corridors, whether that's the Las Vegas Strip, Banff Avenue, or in Latin America, we have the Plaza de Armas, that central kind of square. Many tourism destinations do everything they can to try and make sure that the visitors stay in their area and the residents get to stay in their own area.
And I want to touch a little bit on a little bit of a different topic, which is alternative trails, which is something that I saw to deal with unbalanced tourism specifically. I actually watched your video earlier today on the Salcantay Trail in like leading to Machu Picchu in Peru. Can you tell me a little bit about how trails like these help with unbalanced tourism?
Absolutely. So within tourism, within mass tourism, there's this concept called first and second cities. Everyone wants to go to Rome. Everyone wants to go to Florence in Italy. A second city would be Turin, maybe. And certainly many others. So the basic idea is that you have the principal attraction, and in this case, within Peru, you have Machu Picchu and the Inca Trail. And then you have alternatives. So the Salcantay would be considered a second trail, an alternative trail. And what we're trying to do today, what we, I guess, the global tourism community is trying to do today is visitor dispersal. And visitor dispersal usually means trying to get people to visit those second and third cities, those second and third trails, and that spreads out that visitation much better and more sustainably.
Kind of looking at that specifically, because you're moving tourists away from the main tourist spots and into like these secondary positions, how would this affect locals specifically? Because I would assume it would be very discomforting to have like a massive amount of tourists in your home. What steps can be taken or are being taken to reduce the impact of tourists on locals' everyday lives?
That is probably one of the biggest issues in tourism today. And more destinations around the world are starting to adopt a residents-first approach. With respect to the Sukhan Thai Trail, there's a kind of interesting story. And the story is that we started visiting that trail in around 2009, and we met with a whole series of local families that were experiencing tourism, literally going through their backyard. We ended up doing a little bit of a project to try and better understand what those tourists were looking for and how local families could economically and socially and culturally begin to participate in the tourism that was literally going through their backyard. And we embarked on that project. And some of the families that we work with set up little campgrounds. They set up little stores, just enough to earn second incomes to send their children to school and to improve their lives in general.
I just want to wrap it around kind of back to where we started here. On rather than the economic impact and how they profit from it, what steps can we take to reduce the impact and discomfort that locals may feel?
It's very difficult to control tourism visitation and crowding in a non-gated environment. Within an arena or Disneyland where you have turnstiles and gates, it's much easier to do that. Within a place like New York or Banff or Machu Picchu, most places around the world, it's non-gated. And other more subtle measures have to be implemented. One of the most important ones is to try and direct tourists, visitors, to their areas, to those tourism corridors, such that the residents can maintain a very positive quality of life. And I'll give you a very quick example. Las Vegas, as a city, is ranked in one of the is consistently ranked as one of the most livable cities in the world. Yet it has a strip that is renowned for its very interesting tourism. Las Vegas as a city is a wonderful model of how to create that corridor and how to create that separation such that residents get to live their lives and the tourists get to have their experience. This is not always easy. Venice, on the other hand, not so easy. Many cities, it's not so easy. But I think that is a type of measure that we're moving towards.
Now, talking about specifically tourists and their impact on the city, I wanted to ask you about a quote that I found while I was doing some research for this interview. By Doug Lansky. It was a TED Talk. He said, a city should have tourists, but tourists shouldn't have the city. What is your opinion?
That's a very good line. And I would say that Doug Lansky is talking about this phenomenon that most of us know, that pretty much everyone around here understands very well. And that would be a platform such as Airbnb. So what Doug Lansky is talking about is that a city should have tourists, absolutely. But the tourists should not have a run of the city. So going back to that earlier principle of the tourist corridor, the Plaza de Ramas, the local beaches, et cetera, that is, it's a key issue. Now, that brings in something like Airbnb. So Airbnb, by its very nature, is renting out resident accommodation to visitors. In many cases, those resident accommodations are going to be in residential areas. And that brings tourists into residential areas. I always find it interesting when I speak to people and they say, oh, Joe, you know what? We only do Airbnb because we want to stay away from those tourist areas. And we really want to see how the residents live. And my first thought is, I'm not sure they want to see you. I'm not sure, I think that the residents would prefer that you got a hotel room in the tourist corridor. But it's interesting because you have a lot of these visitors who come in and they're looking for this wildly authentic experience. But that authentic experience and that desire to not be with other tourists, which I think is another podcast in and of itself. We can get to that one later. But to not be with other tourists is actually quite harmful to the destination. Yet it's often seen as kind of a badge of honor. I don't hang out in tourist areas. I hang out in the residential areas. And yeah, that's a whole other story, but it's a good one. It's a good one.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about organic growth of locations or destinations. How does this occur?
Well, it occurs in many, many, many different ways, but I'll give you sort of a typical pathway. So a typical pathway is that you have adventuresome types of tourists who want to go off, and whether it's an urban destination or a more remote wilderness destination, and they discover it in a touristic sense. They don't discover it, but they discover it in a touristic sense. And it becomes popular in a very small niche way. The cachet that these early adopters, adventuresome types of people have, which has been expedited hugely in the age of social media and the phone, brings a lot of attention to this area. And then, of course, everyone is looking for that new area. So once we identify a handful of new, as we say, you know, as of yet undeveloped areas, there is a whole trove of lesser adventuresome people that really want to get out and see those areas. So that's the whole demand side. On the supply side, what you have is you have visitors coming in, and often that is they are hosted in a non-commercial way, whereby the residents will simply invite people into their home. Once that starts to increase, it's not sustainable. So then we have this commercial exchange occurring where I'm going to invite you into my home, but you're going to pay for it. I will make you meals and you're going to pay for them. And then when a critical mass gets to a point, you know, a certain point, and it's going to be different in different areas, but when it gets to a certain point, then there is the economic argument to create purpose-built environments. A purpose-built environment would be a hotel. It would be a restaurant. Hosting generally occurs within the home at first, and then it moves to purpose-built environments. And once you move to purpose-built environments, then it really depends on who moves in and how it evolves from there.
Okay. And lastly, I kind of wanted to ask you, what advice would you give to tourists or the tourism industry as a whole to try to improve the situation of unbalanced tourism?
I would say, I think that the tourism industry, and we would say that that's the whole supply side, right? You know, the tourism industry is going through a movement right now, and that movement is towards intentionality and purpose. And it manifests itself in many destinations now, I guess, refining their tourism narrative. And that tourism narrative is, we are happy to host visitors as long as there are not too many, as long as we reap the economic benefit, as long as we get to portray our culture in an authentic way. And that as long as principle could address any number of different variables. But we're really starting to see that. And we call that purposeful travel. So travel with intention behind it. From a demand side, from a visitor side, this is what I would say. I would say that people need to travel in a way that is equally thoughtful. People need to really think about why they're traveling, not just how or where, but why they're traveling. And one of the things that we say is that the purpose of travel should be to create a better global citizen. And a global citizen does their best work at home. So what we hope is that when you and I go on a trip and we have these wonderful experiences, we are somewhat transformed. And we're transformed in a way that when we come back, we see the world a little bit differently. And we're perhaps more compassionate, we're kinder, we're more curious. Who knows? But we're just better people.
That's Joe Pavelka, longtime professor at MRU and expert on ecotourism. We talked about tourism and the many methods used to keep it sustainable, but tourism isn't even possible without methods to get to travel destinations.
If you've ever gone on vacation, chances are good that you had to take a plane to get there. But with our world more interconnected than ever, that means more planes in the air, throwing pollutants right where we don't want them to be. Chris Gillanders, assistant professor of aviation at MRU, has had a long career in aviation and knows that there is still plenty of work to do when it comes to sustainability in aviation. I sat down with Gillanders to chat more about sustainable aviation and what that means, and how it may shape the future of aviation and the prospects of future pilots. So yeah, just to start, just tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do with the aviation program here at MRU.
Yeah, so my name is Chris Gillanders. I've been with Mount Royal since the end of 2018 with the aviation program here. I'm the assistant professor with the aviation program. So I have varied roles. One of my roles is that I conduct a lot of academic training for the pilot students that we have within the program. And I also work with the chair and dean on advising and developing course development and content. And the most recent development of that is the degree program that we're putting together in aviation management.
Yeah, right on. And like, of course, as I said before, journalism wasn't my first choice. I didn't want to be a pilot, so I guess, you know, like I've worked a lot with some of the aviation professors doing interviews with them. Like I profiled Chrissy a while back.
Right.
But I guess kind of touching on that, the sustainability forum is pretty new, so like, tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, the obviously sustainability, how we can lower our carbon footprint in industry, is a big focus right now in industry, and including in aviation, it's a very large focus and a growing area of interest in how we're going to lower our carbon footprint within aviation. So the forum was designed to highlight what is going on in various industry and what is going on within at education levels on campus as far as what's going on within the industries we learn about here.
And I was at your presentation naturally, and you kind of focus on sustainable aviation.
Sure.
So kind of just tell me a little bit more about what that means.
Yeah, well, the industry, as you know, well, firstly, like, aviation is growing monumentously across the planet, right? We're looking at doubling our global aviation fleet over the next 20, 30 years. We're looking to double that fleet. So the question is, that's a lot of carbon and emissions going into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And as airlines fly at 45,000 feet and deposit those emissions right where we don't want them to be deposited. So mm-hmm. So there is a lot of a drive and interest within commercial aviation as to how we're going to go forward and lower those emissions. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the focus within sustainable aviation is around sustainable aviation fuels initially right now, because that is something we can actually do right now. And obviously looking at new technologies, so new propulsion systems, new ways of building aircraft where they're more aerodynamically efficient, so you lower the fuel burn, etc. So there's a lot of work going on in the industry to try to lower carbon emissions overall.
Yeah, I remember you kind of really talking about that, and especially like kind of like the benefits and drawbacks that our current technologies have, right?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that. Like, what are some of like the, you know, like the current benefits and drawbacks that we're looking at right now?
Yeah, well, you know, if we just look at engine propulsion technology, for example, over the past, say, 15 years, you know, we've watched like the standard engine that's on, say, a 737 or an Airbus A320, which everybody in the country has gotten on if they've traveled anywhere, they've flown on a 737, and that CFM56 engine that is the propulsion system for those aircraft. You know, they've decreased the emissions on those engines and created efficiencies by about 50% over time. So that's a significant savings. But like everything else, every time you create emissions reductions through technological advancements, we're also flying more globally, so we're creating more emissions. So some of the focus has been to the sustainable aviation fuel side. Because obviously if you can come up with a fuel that you can burn in the aircraft that has less emissions, that would be the most immediate bang for your buck, because we can't immediately redesign aircraft and we can't overnight change how aircraft operate, but we can change the fuel that we put in the aircraft and lower emissions that way. And I think, you know, so there's a lot of promotion of sustainable aviation fuels, but there is some realities to limitations on those fuels and how they can be rolled out in enough volume to meet the needs of the industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of challenges there. And I remember you were talking about how, you know, we have more like electrically powered, battery powered aircraft that we're looking at, but there's obviously drawbacks to those as well.
Yeah, well, we do. I mean, there is an area of aviation that is definitely working on electric propulsion for aircraft. It's just the weight and the size of the battery is the issue. And so who's looking at that? Well, you know, some of the freight companies like UPS, FedEx, for example, they look at smaller interregional freight aircraft that are maybe flying 45 minutes or an hour, and they'll carry a very small amount of tonnage, but it has to be shipped very quickly. You know, they find the electric aircraft to be quite advantageous to them. We are not going to see anytime soon an electric aircraft that is carrying 300 people wide body from Calgary to London, for example. The battery technology just isn't there yet. So again, it comes back to, like, if we look at how we're moving people around the world with wide body long haul flight, that's going to come back to sort of employing sustainable aviation fuels in the interim while we work out, you know, more modern technologies that can actually give us propulsion options going forward.
And you mentioned another thing about electric powered aircraft is that, you know, we just need rare earth minerals to, you know, get those batteries, right? And so ultimately, you know, demand means more mining, and that just causes an entirely different problem.
Yeah, well, there is no, I mean, you know, if we're being perfectly clear, sometimes the industry likes to talk around everything sort of net neutral. Like if you have an aircraft that doesn't emit carbon, therefore it's a net neutral system. It's not, because to get the battery material out of the earth, obviously, we would have massive mining across the planet, which would destroy ecosystems. So it's not as simple as just saying, oh, we're going to replace everything we do with batteries. That's just, you know, because there is a net negative effect when we do that level of mining and destroy ecosystems while we do that type of mining, which is very ecologically not very healthy for us. So. Right. So I think we have to be looking at you know, why are we increasing our transportation, and what are our needs versus our wants, and looking at our choices as people as to how much we travel as well.
And kind of following up on that, like, considering all these challenges, but how you mentioned, you know, that focus on, you know, sustainable fuels is kind of helping. With things like that, do you think that the industry is still on the way to achieving a more sustainable framework?
I think the industry's got a long way to go. I think the industry is good at promoting. For example, just the other day, I believe it was Virgin Atlantic did a transatlantic flight, not a commercial flight, but a test flight on sustainable aviation fuels, right? And they say, there, we're doing, you know, we've proven that we can do sustainable, we can do flying with SAF fuels. That is not new. We've known we can fly jet engines on different types of fuels for many, many years. So that's not going to be an issue. The issue is the scalability. You know, how are we producing sustainable aviation fuels? If we're taking sustainable aviation fuels from feedstock, such as corn, wheat, etc., you know, we're basically taking away land, critical land we need for food crops to produce fuel to move airplanes around. So the scalability is not there right now. Like we have like less than 0.01% of the global aviation fuel supply comes from sustainable aviation fuel. So there's a long way to go. There is an active move to scale it up, but it's going to take some time.
We keep trying to put out one fire by starting another one right next to it. Following up on that a little bit, you mentioned that like one of the best ways to achieve a more sustainable aviation framework is to just travel less. How can we go about that?
Well, you know, that's one way to look at it. I mean, I think I mentioned that to be somewhat dramatic, but I think we do have to think as a society, how much are we traveling? Like, do we really need to be doing several holiday trips a year? We're going to have to start looking at our own footprint. I think, and we're going to have to work with government and regional agencies to look at how we travel. For example, the CEO of KLM came out not too long ago and said, listen, if you're taking a trip in Europe under 2 hours, you should be taking a train. And I think train, you know, mass transit, train transport, more efficient movement of personnel and people, you know, is probably a way we're going to have to look at things, or we should be looking at things in the future, and looking at how we reduce our personal footprint on a daily basis. But certainly looking at our own actions is something that we should all be responsible for.
Adding on that, how would lower demand kind of like shake up the industry as a whole?
Well, I think, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? So the industry is good at adapting. So I'm not going to sit here and, you know, obviously there would be executives within industry saying, Don't advocate that we slow down. We're just having a boom. We're coming out of COVID. Our numbers are back up. Our transport numbers are back up. Our passenger numbers are back up. Cargo's back up. Obviously, there's an incentive for the industry, aviation industry, to keep growing. The fact is, we cannot keep growing. We don't have infinite resource. We have finite resource that we can apply to continue building aircraft and continue finding source material for batteries, et cetera. We're doing damage to a lot of communities that we fly to for mass tourism, for example. And those communities are starting to fight back and say, look, the ecological impact of mass tourism for our communities is not good. I think getting back to your question as to what would happen to a slowdown. The industry has been very, very flexible. It has gone through financial upturns and downturns, and it adapts, right? You get, you know, if you're in a downturn, you fly less aircraft, you need less personnel, you optimize your routing structure, etc. So there are ways for the industry to adapt and still stay robust. And you know, if we have seen throughout history with aviation, we've seen, especially in the commercial aviation industry, we see consolidations, and we see consolidations within the industry between various companies, etc. So I think the industry is resilient. It adapts to the global market situation, and it'll carry on and be pretty healthy.
So ultimately, even in spite of having to, you know, like, just stop this growth and to kind of, you know, achieve a more sustainable framework, prospective pilots like me and others, you know, they shouldn't be worried about their job prospects in the future?
No, I don't think so. I think if you're a prospective pilot, you've got a long career ahead of you, simply due to demographics. We have more pilots retiring than we have pilots that are being trained. And so that means that even if we were, and we're not, by the way, like, to be clear, we can talk about this philosophically all we want, but the fact is the global aviation industry is going to double. It is the, we're not going to hold back that train. And we're going to need pilots, air crew, mechanical engineers, management within the industry. And so that's not going to hold back at all. That growth pattern is still there to double in the next 30 years. So, if you're a young person thinking you want to be a pilot, your career prospects are still pretty good, even if we go through dips and bumps in the global economy and slowdowns. Yeah.
But ultimately, they'll still have a world to fly in, ultimately.
Ultimately, and we'll still be flying people around, and we'll still need pilots, and we'll still need more aircraft just because of the growth of the global population. Yeah.
That was Chris Gillanders, Assistant Professor of Aviation at MRU, talking about sustainable aviation. Thanks for listening to Roots, today's sustainability scene. I'm Sean Gillanders.
And I'm Alejandro Velasco.
This series is powered by Shaw and a part of the Community Podcast Initiative at Mount Royal University. It was produced on the lands of the Niitsitapi Blackfoot, Ayahe Nakota, Sutina, and Métis peoples. We recognize the stewards of these lands and the knowledge they bring to our understanding of sustainability. Special thanks to Mauricio Latapi, who organized MRU Sustainability Forum and has been so supportive in helping us put this series together. Be sure to subscribe to the show to hear the latest episodes and discover new podcasts from the Community Podcast Initiative on our website, thepodcaststudio.ca.